You're so cute. And I'm really good in bed, too, believe me. No? Okay.
When your life is on the rocks, and you can't remember how it got there, it's time to move on.
We're gonna let you go, okay?
Okay.
What are you gonna do now?
I thought I'd move out to Las Vegas. A blush on your cheek.
Ben wasn't planning to start a new life. And he wasn't asking for a second chance. But on the road to oblivion, he got lonely.
If you'll come to my room for 1 hour, I will give you $500.
Sarah thought her life was as it should be. And then she met Ben.
Why don't you stay at my place tonight?
Okay. Wow. You look extremely beautiful.
I do.
And against all the odds, these two unlucky people fall head over heels.
Oh my God.
Just say we'll say. Nicolas Cage.
Nurse!
Elizabeth Shue.
So what's it tonight? Another 500 to watch you sleep.
It looks like I'm with the right girl.
Leaving Las Vegas.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCriscio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
Good. As always, very excited to talk about a Nicolas Cage movie, especially especially this one. This is the beginning of peak Nicolas Cage.
This is the big one, gentlemen. I'm saying gentlemen to refer to you, I guess.
I guess.
Gentleman.
Sure.
Here it is, gentleman.
It's, thanks, Mike.
This is the big one. As far as like critical acclaim and awards recognition goes, I feel like this is the Nicolas Cage performance.
It is.
Right? I mean, so we've reached 1995. And that means we have reached the performance that won Nicolas Cage the Academy Award for Best Actor, his role as Ben Sanderson in the addiction drama Leaving Las Vegas.
We did it. We made it, Ma.
Top of the world, Ma.
Top of the world.
We made it. Now we can shut this whole podcast down. We're finally done.
Only took 26 episodes to get to the good one.
And now we're done. We're going to cut it off before The Rock and before Con Air and before Face Off, before some of the most well-known Nicolas Cage movies of all time. We're just going to call it quits.
Yeah,
right,
give
now
it up.
Before we get into the awards and the decorations, some background. Leaving Las Vegas was based on a novel by John O'Brien, who wrote the story as somewhat autobiographical in nature. He killed himself just 2 weeks after the film went to production, which cast a shadow on the movie and put it into jeopardy. But director Mike Figgis ultimately decided to move forward with the movie, seeing it as a very fitting tribute to John O'Brien in a lot of ways. Now, Mike Figgis is an experimental filmmaker. I have not seen anything else he's ever directed. Mike, I don't know if you have or not.
No, not from the list I saw when I checked out his Wikipedia. I don't think I recognize anything.
All right. I mean, based on what I've seen in Leaving Las Vegas, it does have a lot of experimental tones. But I feel like after reading about some of his other movies, I feel like this may be one of his most mainstream works, which might explain why it was as big of a hit as it was.
Right.
But it is still pretty unconventional when compared to most mainstream movies, especially at that time. An example of one movie that he directed a movie called Time Code, which is a movie made to experiment with the then new digital technology that was right when digital filmmaking started happening.
Right.
And so the way that movie plays out is it shows four 93-minute continuous takes simultaneously. So it's like a quadrant thing where it's like there's four different shots
going on
the
whole time.
Once, and it's just not long takes for each one, and that's the entire movie.
Yeah, that's pretty textbook experimental.
Yeah. So this is not like that. It's a little more loose and a little more unconventional than your usual mainstream Oscar-worthy melodrama.
Right.
You might say. He most recently directed a 2012 thriller called Suspension of Disbelief. Now, Leaving Las Vegas focuses almost entirely on Nicolas Cage's alcoholic Ben Sanderson and Elizabeth Shue's prostitute Sarah. The only other significant role is Julian Sands as Yuri, Sarah's abusive pimp, who disappears about 30 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, disappears is one way to say it.
Yeah, sure. A spoiler-free.
Yeah, it's implied that bad things happen to him.
Right.
Many of the smaller roles in this movie are played by very well-known people, or else actors who would become well-known later on. I don't know if you caught some of those cameos, Mike, but
I feel like I probably did, but I don't remember.
All right. Good work. This is a great this podcast is off to a great start. Well, many of these cameos include Richard Lewis.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay.
Steven Weber is in this movie. Laurie Metcalf, Arlie Ermey, Xander Berkeley, Mariska Hargitay from Law & Order SVU, yes. Who is a silent hooker in this movie.
I think she has a line.
She might have one line.
One line, maybe.
You mostly just see her smoldering across the hall, across a bar or something.
Yep.
And Emily Proctor, who, if that name may ring a bell to you, she was the other lead of CSI Miami.
Welcome to the CSI Miami cast.
Meaning both of Nicolas Cage's movies from 1995 had him share at least one scene opposite a future lead of CSI Miami. And I think that's pretty cool. Speaking as someone who has never watched CSI Miami, I think that's a neat, fun fact.
Thanks, Mike. This is the whole reason we do the podcast.
Yeah, it's for me to imbue you with fun facts that nobody else finds as fun as I do.
Yes.
And yes, Nicolas Cage won the Oscar for this role. Elizabeth Shue was also nominated for the Oscar for Best Actress, though she lost to Susan Sarandon for Dead Man Walking. And Mike Figgis was nominated for Best Director, which he lost to Mel Gibson for Braveheart. And he was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay as well, losing to Sense and Sensibility. So Nicolas Cage was the only Oscar-winning element of this movie. For his part, Nicolas Cage beat out Richard Dreyfuss for Mr. Holland's Opus, Anthony Hopkins for Nixon, Massimo Troisi for Il Porcino, the Postman, and Sean Penn for Dead Man Walking. You know Sean Penn, Nicolas Cage's Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Racing with the Moon co-star.
That's right, that guy.
Yeah, that's got to be it's got to be rough for Sean Penn.
You know? You could say that this was the best of times for Nicolas Cage.
Okay. That is, of course, referring to the very first thing we ever reviewed Nicolas Cage in, which Sean Penn was not in.
No, I know. But I felt like it's been a while since we've talked about Best of Times, so I just wanted to bring it up.
That's right. We should bring up Best of Times every once in a while, just to remind us of where he came from.
The humble beginnings that led to this Oscar-worthy performance.
Yeah, did you... I mean, when you watch Best of Times, because you see the Oscar-worthy Nicolas Cage in the scene where he reenacts Rocky, while grossing out his friend who's eating a sandwich?
In that scene? I don't think so. But there was the one scene we did talk about. I remember the when he's talking about being drafted to go to Vietnam.
Oh, right. The really weird dramatic scene that came out of nowhere?
Yep, that one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Very that was good okay.
There. Let's get off Best of Times. Back to Leaving Las Vegas. This film was also nominated at the BAFTAs and at the Golden Globes. Cage won another award at the Golden Globes there. And it cleaned up at the Independent Spirit Awards, where it won three awards. It won Best Cinematography, it won Best Female Lead for Elizabeth Shue, and it won Best Film. So that's pretty cool. And then watching Nicolas Cage's performance in this movie, I can see why it's so acclaimed. And it almost plays like the apex of everything he had done up to this point.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
The first couple minutes, because this movie, we said it's sort of experimental, more conventional than it is experimental, but it has weird things.
Right.
The opening credits don't happen until like 7 or 8 minutes into the movie.
Actually, it's 15 minutes into the
movie. Is it really 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Wow.
But you were so enthralled by what was happening, it seemed like half the time.
I assumed the movie had just begun, so I was like, whatever, this is it. But those first 15 minutes or so, I was a little like, Nicolas, really? This is the one? Like, it feels like those first 15 minutes are the, you know, Nicolas Cage at 12 or 11, he is kind of at that point throughout most of the movie.
Right.
But he sort of plays a drunk guy the way, like, I play my D&D character drunk. Just, like, slur every word and be an idiot, and it's fine. And I was like, that's really the one. But then as the movie, we move on, we get to Las Vegas and like the movie starts, quote unquote.
Right.
It's way more, Oscar worthy. It's way more subdued and nuanced into in his drunkenness and his, it's, you know, mutually assured destruction in the movie.
yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I would say, yeah, you know, now we're 26 movies into Nicolas Cage's career. He's played all different kinds of roles, but I think he always has this very specific kind of energy about him that can only be described as Nicolas Cage, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And there are sequences in this movie, especially in the beginning, that evoke some of his wilder roles, you know? But there is, like, an undercurrent of sadness surrounding it as the movie goes on. And it kind of makes it not enjoyable in the same way as you are when you're watching, like, Deadfall.
Right.
Right? Like, Deadfall you watch, and it's kind of hilarious. And it's, like, sort of amazing watching that performance, like, just how insane he gets in that movie. Yeah. Here, you know, he's playing a lot of the same kind of types. He's doing a lot of the same kind of ridiculous stuff going on, but there's an undercurrent of melancholy under it all. So, for example, I mean, I think the 15-minute prologue in which Cage is getting drunker and drunker, and he's losing all of his connections,
right?
I think it plays a lot like his role in Vampire's Kiss, right?
Yes,
he taps into that same energy, but it's for a different purpose. And actually, I was reading about his process for this role to prepare for this role. This is insane.
I'm so excited
to prepare for this role. Nicolas Cage went to Ireland, and he binge drank for 2 straight weeks. While he had a friend film him.
Okay.
And then after the binge drinking fortnight, he he watched the film that his friend took, and he studied his own speech patterns and his movements while he was drunk to more effectively capture what he's like when he's drunk.
Yeah, that's pretty insane. You're right.
So I thought that was really interesting. And also Elizabeth Shue actually went and interviewed and spent time with a lot of Las Vegas prostitutes while preparing for this role as well. In any case, Leaving Las Vegas was made for a pretty low budget of $3.6 million, and it made back $32 million, which is almost 10 times what that movie cost. That is a huge hit in the art house world. You know, it got a limited release in October 95 before expanding, you know, got the Oscar qualifying run
right in
95 so that it can get awards, and then went nationwide, I think, in February, right before the Oscars hit, I believe.
Okay.
So that way, you know, all the hype was around this movie, so it could be as successful as it was. And it definitely worked in its favor. I think people really responded to this movie. The IMDb plot synopsis reads, Ben Sanderson, an alcoholic Hollywood screenwriter who lost everything because of his drinking, arrives in Las Vegas to drink himself to death. There, he meets and forms an uneasy friendship and non-interference pact with prostitute Sarah.
Yeah. That's pretty spot on.
Yeah.
It's one of the better IMDb synopses.
Yeah, actually, it's solid. It tells you exactly what the movie is. And, it's not really a movie that has much of a plot. You know,
right.
It's mostly you're just watching these two people interact with each other and how they're reacting to each other's kind of brokenness in that kind of sense.
Yeah, this is definitely one of those movies where you could watch it and say nothing happened, but there's so much between Ben and Sarah that it doesn't need any kind of plot in some weird way.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Its emphasis is on character rather than story.
Yeah,
exactly. So Leaving Las Vegas was written and directed by Mike Figgis and based on the novel by John O'Brien. The film stars Nicolas Cage as Ben Sanderson, Elizabeth Shue as Sarah, and Julian Sands as Yuri, among several other people. I'm not going to mention all of them. I've already mentioned a few. So, Mike, what are your overall thoughts on this movie?
Well, I mean, like I said, for the most part, well, for the first 15 minutes or so, I was like, I was a little iffy on the fence because it's Nicolas Cage at 12, which doesn't really fit the tone. Like we had said, it's supposed to be a melancholy, sad movie, and his manic, drunken, just slur everything doesn't really seem to fit with that, with what the movie is trying to do.
Right.
As we move to Vegas and we get to watch his suicide by drinking, he tones down he comes down from 12 a little bit for portions of it, and we actually get to see what he is as a character, because in that prologue we know nothing about him other than he got fired and he's an alcoholic.
Right.
I mean, even in the other portions of it, that's basically all we know also. But
right. We never really get a sense of who he was before all this happened.
Yeah,
right. I mean, it's implied that his wife left him.
Right.
But otherwise, you don't really know much about him.
Yeah, I think we see a family photo once. We see him, a woman, and a child. But that's about all we know. And I totally am a little shocked at how this was such a big hit. I don't know. It's an art house movie is what it is.
Yeah.
So I think Cage definitely deserves the Oscar. It's interesting to see who he was up against, those, you know, those names that he's right. against. And you're like, there's no way Cage wins. especially for such a weird role. But it is, he portrays the self-destructive, just downward spiral of this character's, you know, last month or however long it is. It's not a very long time
right.
that we're with them. In such a way that I think he deserves it as well. I think Elizabeth Shue really sort of ends up, Sarah becomes the protagonist for the last,
yeah, I would say
the last half of the movie for the most part. I mean, she's literally the narrator for most of it. So I'm surprised to see that she didn't win that. But yeah, I mean, those are kind of my just rambling thoughts.
Okay. Yeah. I thought the movie was pretty great. It had a very interesting structure. I thought Cage and Shue were really giving it their all in this movie. It feels very unconventional, but it tells the story very effectively. And also, I felt like it never feels like it's judging Ben or Sarah based on their life decisions. It kind of just simply presents them as fact.
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting. I thought that was kind of refreshing. Like, it's like, obviously we know that these are bad things that these people are doing. But it's also like Cage is very like powerless against his alcoholism. Sarah still has some kind of glimmer of hope that she can change her life around. But she's kind of addicted to Cage. She kind of needs Cage there in her life at that point in time. And so I feel like this movie never once kind of makes you feel like the movie is looking down on these characters. It's kind of just presenting them, which I liked. I liked that a lot in this movie. And yeah, I thought Cage was phenomenal in this. You know, there's a lot of layers to his performance here. It's the rare role that can give his on-screen insanity a narrative purpose and emotional pathos.
Like, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, he always, like, everything about, like, just the way he kind of looks in certain scenes in this movie, like, he always looks incredibly off and, like, out there. You know, he has this this vacant stare in this movie that is kind of just mesmerizing. You know, and he's there's bits in the movie where he's like kind of caked in like greenish makeup. Like he always looks like he's sick in some way in this movie.
He's been on a 2-week drinking binge.
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought his relationship with Elizabeth Shue felt very real. You know, the result of these two broken people finding each other, if only for a short time. I think this is the apex of everything he's done so far. You know, there's shades of every performance Cage has given here. You know, the jumped up craziness of Vampire's Kiss or Deadfall. There's the aggressiveness of Kiss of Death. There's the romantic leading man aspects of Moonstruck or Honeymoon in Vegas. There's the weird line readings of Peggy Sue Got Married or Trapped in Paradise.
Yep, absolutely. And that's one of the things that, like you said, gives his insanity a narrative purpose. That's exactly, he's allowed to get away with so many of those quirks we talk about in this, you know, in the previous episodes of like, why would he do that? That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But
he finally found a role where it makes sense.
Yeah. But his character's been drunk for 3 weeks straight. So yeah.
It makes sense. So like sense anything
that
goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is now, Cage is now 14 years into his career at this point with this movie. And he has found the role that I think completely defines his career up to that point, which I think is really interesting. And it kind of closes the book on that era of his career, you know, this kind of rising actor status,
right.
You know, up until the point where he wins an Oscar in 1995. After this, you're going to see him in a lot more mainstream Hollywood blockbuster stuff.
Right.
Whereas before this, you see him in a lot more varied kind of things. There's still definitely Hollywood movies in there. He tried to go for action movies once with Firebirds, and that didn't really pan out.
That didn't work so much.
But, you know, in that time frame, you see him going for Wild at Heart. You see him going for Rumblefish. You see him starring in a lot of these interesting independent films that you're going to see less of going forward, I think. So it's almost the end of this era of his career.
Right.
Which I find very interesting.
Yeah, this is we enter peak Cagedom in pop culture right. at this point.
Peak Hollywood superstar Cage. You
know, yeah,
this is him winning an Oscar, and actually in his Oscar acceptance speech, he champions the making of small movies. Like he says, like, oh, this was the small movie that, you know, we need more movies like this out there. You know, support independent artists, and right. then immediately after doing this movie, he stars in three of the biggest action movies of the '90s.
Oh, way to undercut your own message there, Mr. Cage.
But yeah, so Mike, were there any moments or scenes in this movie that stood out to you in any way?
Well, that's kind of the thing. Every scene stands out and yet doesn't. I don't think there's one in particular that's... I mean, there's no scene that, you know, stands out as the pinnacle scene for me.
Right. I mean, there's not a defining scene in the movie, I would say. But there's a lot of very good scenes.
Right.
Was there anything like that? Like, give me a scene that you liked. Give me a scene that...
The scene that I thought really... Or one of them that, you know, well, I guess every scene exemplifies this Ben's self-destructiveness.
Right.
But when he, I think it's one of the first nights he spends at Sarah's, and he goes out for breakfast, or I don't remember the exact thing, but he goes to a bar, and
right.
It's like a biker bar, and he gets in a fight.
Yes.
Yeah, that scene. And there are so many things, that, and one of my favorite things about Ben's as a character is when he hits that point of... drunkenness, he like starts quoting poetry and
right.
and you know, using Shakespearean language and
right.
this lofty weird accent.
Yes, when he comes back from the bar, he's she was cleaning him up and she was like, what happened? Did you like, oh, I was doth protecting a fair maiden from,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
needed an honor for her honor or something.
Yeah,
she's like, I bet you
yeah, and those things happen, or you know, he talks like that a couple times throughout the film, and it's
right.
and it's one funny, like the situation he was in.
Right.
But I think it added some weird depth that when Ben gets that drunk, he actually thinks that way. Like, you know.
Right. I think it hints at an intelligence in Ben that's going
right.
squandered.
Yes. Yeah.
Because of his drinking problem. Also, in that scene, actually, just cameo thrown in there, Julian Lennon is the bartender. He's the son of John Lennon.
Okay.
So just throwing that out there.
More cameos.
Yeah. Actually, almost every minor role in this movie is some kind of significant person, like, you know, cameo-wise. And some of them are even people who would just go on to be significant, like, famous people. I thought the freak-out scene at the casino was very good. I liked that one a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of... Because it shows Cage kind of going from in control to out of control very quickly. You know, he's
yeah.
there with Shu, and they're having fun, they're having a good time, and then suddenly, like, almost out of nowhere, he's, like, upends the table, and he's getting escorted out by security. I thought that was a very good scene. And you're right, the film's perspective does kind of switch halfway through. You know, the first half is about Cage discovering Shu, I would say, and it mostly follows him.
Right.
And then the second half is Shu living with Cage and kind of dealing with his alcoholism, and it mostly follows her.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an effective narrative device, I think. And then yeah, throughout the movie... you see Shu talking to the camera, like a talking head interview for a documentary about her relationship with Cage. I thought that
right.
was an effective narrative device as well.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I guess I didn't think of it in those terms, but it's the same, you know, same thing. I was wondering, is that supposed to be her talking to like a therapist of some sort? Is how I took it, but the documentary, it's the same effect.
Yeah, I guess a therapist would be a possible thing. I think that would probably be the most likely thing, but it's never really explained. I think it's just a narrative device.
Right. Yeah. We never see what is going on.
Right.
On the other side of that.
Yeah, that's part of what I think makes this film unconventional from mainstream movies, because most movies won't have a character talking to an unseen being.
Right.
for most of its runtime. So I thought that was very effective.
Yeah.
I think one of the key scenes in the movie is when Cage moves into Sarah's house, and Sarah gets him a couple of housewarming presents, and one of them is a flask.
Right.
Which I think essentially defines their relationship.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that was very effective and you know, very interesting. The scene where Elizabeth Shue gets raped by idiot teenagers.
Right.
That was brutal. Heartbreaking.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot... I think what you said earlier, too, that the film doesn't take any moral stance for anything that's going on, really. We are placed as in a fly-on-the-wall type situation for a lot of what's happening. I think that the relationship between Sarah and Ben, like you said, that she gives... the one condition that he has when he agrees to move in... is that he never, or that is that she never asks him to stop drinking.
Right.
And they enable each other in the most destructive, beautiful question mark way.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. It's like you can't, it's like a train wreck. You can't take your eyes, you know, you can't stop watching what's happening, what these characters are allowing themselves to do to themselves.
Right, right. But it does come to the point where Sarah actually asks Cage to go see a doctor at some point. I think her journey to get to that point, like to realize like this is destructive for him and it's destructive for her, and to try to get him to get help, is interesting to watch her go through that and ultimately reach that point and then have that backfire on her and kick him out of the house.
Yeah. Yeah. And even in some way, like when they have that conversation and she asks him to go to the doctor, it's like, it's heartbreaking in the, like for both of them. Like, yes, obviously we would want Ben to get help, but in the same way, I don't know, it's like you almost want them to work in the way that they are, like in some weird you kind of hope they don't.
It's kind of amazing how effectively this love story is told when you know like how toxic this relationship is.
Exactly.
like intellectually you realize it, but emotionally you kind of like connect with both of these characters and you want them to succeed almost, but at the same time, like, you know, this can't possibly end well under any circumstances. And the ending in which Cage and Shu finally have sex right before he dies is devastating, man. That was brutal.
That was like, oh, right, art house. Yeah, that was a very, devastating is an appropriate scene, an appropriate term.
Yeah, I think, like, it's an interesting movie tone-wise, because it is, I think, quietly kind of devastating, but also it's kind of like a black comedy in some ways. Like, it's a darkly comedic take on what this is being. I mean, you watch Cage's scenes and like he's doing funny stuff. Like, we've seen him do this kind of stuff in different roles and laughing at that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
So he's not doing that much different than certain other roles he's had, but like at the same time, just the context is so much different. And it changes it a little bit. And so it is, like, there's stuff that you laugh at in this movie as he's, like, you know, being ridiculous and being cagey and being silly. But at the same time, like, you realize how unfunny it all is underneath the funniness almost.
Yeah. Like you said, the things that we would laugh at that he's doing in any other movie are granted seriousness in this one.
Yeah. Which is definitely a change of pace and interesting.
Yeah.
I also think this movie's a very well shot movie. Mike Figgis shot this on 16 millimeter film, which I think gives it like kind of an old timey kind of look, like a little grainier, and kind of paints Las Vegas as this very seedy place, which is in stark contrast. Like, Las Vegas is a really interesting setting for movies, I think, because it's either always painted as this like magical fantasy world or this like underground seedy hellhole.
There's, you know, no in between.
There's no in between. Contrast this with the other Las Vegas movie that Nicolas Cage made, Honeymoon in Vegas.
Right.
Where, you know, Las Vegas is, you know, this movie with flying Elvises coming out of the sky and like you know, people dressed in showgirl outfits like wildly, and you know, it just feels like there's two different versions of Las Vegas you're seeing in both these movies. And I think that's, you know, the way this movie shot, I think, helps show Las Vegas as this less than reputable place.
Right. Yeah, and now that I'm thinking about it, I believe that scene when I don't know why I just thought of this exactly, but it's not really related to Las Vegas as a setting. But when Sarah's rape, I believe, happens after she throws Ben out of the house, right?
Yes, this is he's been thrown out of the house, and it's basically just following Sarah for a while.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like we said, they are a destructive couple or toxic couple, yet after she throws him out of the house, she goes on this kind of sort of reckless spiral herself, where I don't remember exactly what she says, but she's like, oh, I normally only date one person at a time, but yet she still allows to go with a group of teenagers,
right.
And then she ends up being raped, I can't remember she goes on her own self-destructive spiral.
Yes.
In his absence, like, you know, as if Ben's presence had been allowing her to function in some weird way. Without that, she just doesn't care. Despite him trying to kill himself with drinking and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, like we said, it's a toxic relationship, but one that like is so codependent on the other one.
Right.
Which I think makes for a really compelling movie. And so I really enjoyed Leaving Las Vegas. I thought it was very good. You know, Cage and Hsu were very good in it. Mike, you seem to agree.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to talk about before we move into Netflix reviews?
No, I think I just want to say this is, I was not expecting. I didn't know what I was expecting for this movie. But the last 25 episodes of this podcast, it have led me to believe it wouldn't have been this. You know what I mean?
I think you might have been expecting like Oscar bait kind of sort of movie. Like,
yeah, I think I was expecting just more of a straight ahead conventional drama, right, rather than the experimental melodrama about toxic relationships.
Yeah, fair enough. I think this movie exceeded my expectations as well, and you know, it's very good. I think that people should definitely check it out if they haven't. But let's get into some Netflix reviews, Mike.
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. This is reviews for Leaving Las Vegas left on Netflix.com. And there's some interesting ones. Here's a one-star review of Leaving Las Vegas. Nicolas Cage wears green makeup and is awarded Best Actor. Really? Elizabeth Shue is supposed to be a street prostitute. Someone that beautiful will be a rich man's courtesan. Stupid movie.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, take
so
that.
So there's that.
Yeah, take that, green makeup. he does wear green, like this, like kind of gaunt makeup throughout the movie, which I think helps sell the alcoholism bit very well. Here's a 3-star review of Leaving Las Vegas. 3 very dark stars for this movie. It is more of a character study than a plot-driven movie, unless you consider one character getting drunk constantly and the other getting screwed all the time a plot. It was marginally watchable, and the characters, although flawed, seemed believable. However, we really never learned why Nicolas Cage's character is such an unhappy schlub with a death wish. Elizabeth Shue, though, can clean my carpets any day.
What?
She is totally hot. This would be a great movie to show at an AA meeting.
Oh, man.
I gotta know where this guy gets his metaphors from.
Yeah, wow.
She can clean my carpets any day. Here's a 1-star review of Leaving Las Vegas. Wow, what a bad movie! I watched it to see Elizabeth Shue. Even she can't compensate for the offensively repugnant screenplay and yet another bad performance from Nicholas Coppola. Totally unconvincing. Not for the 3-digit IQ set.
Shots fired.
Yeah, I like that he calls him Nicholas Coppola, though.
Yeah, it's like it's personal for him.
Exactly. Here's a 1-star review of Leaving Las Vegas. This movie is a waste of your time. Do not watch it. It's just awful. There is never a clear reason for why he wants to die of alcohol poisoning, much less why the hooker fell in love with him, and the rape scene is out of place. A prostitute never goes through this kind of thing, really. It is just awful.
Lots of assumptions being made in that movie.
Yeah. Very much. So, unless this person is a prostitute.
Right, yeah.
And knows what a prostitute goes through, I feel like, you know, you're kind of just projecting
right
onto whatever this movie is.
In a world they hope they know what that is.
Yeah. So that's very strange. Here's a 4-star review of Leaving Las Vegas. How anyone could enjoy this movie is beyond me. However, it is an important movie because it signifies and represents the point in time when America took a wrong turn. Great Valentine's Day flick. This country is morally bankrupt, and this movie shows us what is wrong and why. Interesting that Ed Harris stars briefly, as he starred in The Abyss, which is what his movie should have been titled. Couple things with that. Ed Harris is not in this movie. I'm pretty confident they meant to put this review on something on a different movie's page.
Maybe.
But it's also something you can't really tell that it's wrong until he gets to the part about Ed Harris. You know, like maybe he really thinks this does signify and represent the point in time when America took a wrong turn.
Maybe.
maybe he really does think this is a great Valentine's Day flick. You know, but Ed Harris is not in this movie. He did star in The Abyss. That is correct.
True.
And I guess this movie could have been titled The Abyss.
That would actually kind of work. Yeah.
Yeah. But in any case, that review is way off base. Also, it's a 4-star review, and he says how anyone can enjoy this is beyond me.
I th- Yeah, I think you're just feeding the trolls at this point. That's all that's happening.
Pretty much. All right, here's a 5-star review of Leaving Las Vegas. This, boys and girls, is how awesome Nicolas Cage used to be before he became Hollywood's harlot and a garbage bag for awful scripts, willing to be part of virtually any obvious flop and cheesy sellout mediocrity for a paycheck. The movie is very well done and features incredible acting, though caution to the sensitive, this movie is quite depressing, yet its quality makes up for it. I mean, he liked it.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem to care much for Nicolas Cage now, though.
No.
Hollywood's harlot, Nicolas Cage. I might start introducing the podcast like that. That's what we should have called this podcast, actually, instead of Complete Works. Hollywood's harlot.
Oh, man. All right, we're just going to have to re-record the first 25 episodes.
That's fine. We remember what we said, right?
Yeah.
Verbatim, word for word.
It's recorded.
All right. And finally, here's a 1-star review of Leaving Las Vegas, which I found very oddly specific. I rented this movie because it was a classic, knowing full well that it is postmodern and dark. I also find Las Vegas as appealing as the decor in any Chinese buffet, but I knew it would work well within the framework of this bleak movie. The musical score was the torpedo which sank this ship. I expected the bad lounge music, which reminds me of cheap onboard entertainment on a cruise ship, but the creepy, high-octave, depressing piano music was far too much to endure. It took its toll on my Wellbutrin, which prescience told me to load up with on the forehand. The other piece I hated was prickly guitar Elvis-esque rock song, which forced me to mute that scene and forego whatever dialogue Nicolas Cage was slurring. Musical scores help make iconic films, but this one actually disemboweled it with the empathy of a serial killer.
Wow.
Any tolerance you had for Cage drinking more alcohol than is medically possible, his ability to drive drunk in front of a traffic cop without getting pulled over, a feat most of us cannot accomplish sober, or prostitute with a level grammar most college graduates do not possess, is destroyed by this terrible score in which songs are played over and over ad nauseum. In short, the music director must hate the audience and want them to suffer. Good job, you asshole.
Wow, that's hilarious. Right? Especially because one of my notes is the soundtrack is pretty incredible.
It was pretty good. I liked the soundtrack quite a bit. Actually, I wrote down that I gave the movie props for not including Viva Las Vegas.
Yep. In the soundtrack. I thought it was going to at one point. I don't remember what song. I was like, oh, really?
Perhaps it was in the scene with the prickly guitar Elvis-esque rock song, which forced this guy to mute that scene.
Yeah, probably.
But just generally speaking, if it's a movie that's set in Las Vegas, it plays Viva Las Vegas at some point. Yep. And this one didn't. So I applaud it for that, you know, avert the cliche. But that is it for Netflix reviews. That's all we have today. I thought we would end on a really good one.
That was good. I wonder if you just didn't find it, but our friend who always comments, this is what Nicolas Cage does best, making great movies.
Yeah, I didn't see it this time around. But maybe I didn't look far enough. You know, we'll see. Hopefully, if anything deserves that comment, it's The Rock. So I imagine next week or next time around, we'll get to that one.
Yeah, I'm sure our friend is out there.
Yeah. All right. So, Mike, you're a fan of Leaving Las Vegas?
I am, yes.
All right, cool. And I'm a fan of Leaving Las Vegas. Definitely check it out if you can. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Help support this podcast and Filmbook by taking part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you are emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different podcasts. It's hard to keep track, Mike. We can't possibly keep track of all the podcasts that we have.
It's impossible.
It's insane the amount of podcasts we have. You have to put it in the subject line so that we can, you know, filter through all the podcast emails that we're getting.
We can wade through the sea of emails.
Exactly. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks when we're kicking off the next phase of Nick Cage's career, action movies. And what better one to start with than with Michael Bay's 1996 masterpiece, The Rock?
Is it? It's The Complete Works, Season 2, Hollywood's Harlot.
Pretty much. This is the beginning of Hollywood's Harlot, Nicolas Cage.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm very excited for to talk about The Rock. I think it's going to be a really
fun. God. This is it, I'm so this it's going to be a
yeah, we've been hyping up The Rock, the Rock Con Air Face Off trilogy for probably a year now. We've been doing this podcast for so long.
It's ludicrous that we get to do those three movies in a row.
Right? Like that's incredible that those were the three movies in a row that he ended up making right after he won the Oscar. Yep. All right. And you can join us for Film Bookcast next week, where we're going to be discussing The Magnificent Seven. I'm excited for that one, too, Mike. Are you excited for The Magnificent Seven?
I am. I'm very pumped for that.
Yeah, I've heard pretty solid things, you know. Mixed to good is what I've heard. But I think at the very least, I think it's just going to be fun to watch those actors in that setting, shooting people. Like, I guess.
Yeah. You know, who doesn't want to see that?
I'm excited just to see Denzel Washington and Chris Pratt bounce off each other and occasionally shoot guys. Like, I think that'll be a fun time. All right. And here to play us out is Nicolas Cage's acceptance speech as he won the Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas. So thanks so much for listening, guys. And thanks for getting in the cage.
Oh, boy. $3.5 million budget, some 16mm film stock thrown in, and I'm holding one of these. I have got to thank the members of the Academy for this, for including me in this group of super talents, and for helping me blur the line between art and commerce with this award. I know it's not hip to say it, but I just love acting, and I hope that there will be more encouragement for alternative movies where we can experiment and fast forward into the future of acting. Let me thank the awesome, multi-talented Mike Figgis. My incredible, amazing co-star, Elizabeth Shue. I am going to share this award with both of you and the late John O'Brien, whose spirit moved me so much. Tony Dingman. Annie Stewart, the producers, Annie Stewart, Stewart Regan, everyone at MGM, UA, I'm sorry, and Lumiere. I'd like to thank Ed LaMotto, my colleagues, Jerry Harrington, Jeff Levine, Richard Lovett, and everyone in my family, my gorgeous wife, Patricia. And I just finally want to say, hi, Weston, it's Daddy. I love you. Thank you.